I'm Steve Gervin, pretending that I'm not a deputy provost this week and doing some physics. I guess relative to you guys, I'm an experimentalist, but theoretically, I'm a condensed matter theorist who works closely with experimental group Rob Sholkoff and Michelle Devere at Yale, working on superconducting electrical circuit realization of cavity QED with quantized microwave photons on quantized energy levels of artificial atoms, and trying to build a quantum computer. And we've recently run the first very simple algorithms on a 2-bit solid-state computer for the first time. So given how little I've understood of the talks I've been going to this week, I hope that you'll feel free to stop me and we can just make this a conversation. You can ask me anything that you'd be embarrassed to ask your physics colleagues at home. I won't tell anybody. So, you know, I'm sure there'll be lots of words that I use that whose meaning is obvious to me but may not be to you. So please just stop me if I lose you. So there's some, at least for the physics community, some useful, interesting reviews. And really what we're talking about here is the quantum mechanics of electrical circuits. And some elements of those electrical circuits act as harmonic oscillators, resonators that hold 0, 1, 2, 3, 4 microwave photons. And microwaves, despite their name, are particles. The particles have 100,000 times less energy than visible photons, so they're pusillanimous, but they're still quantum particles. And now we're beginning to be able to do quantum optics with them in a condensed matter world. So I know some of you are interested in dirt and noise, and there's a lot of noise around that messes up qubits. And our engineering goal is, you can either try to get rid of it, which we think is impossible, or design a qubit that's robust against it, which, as I will show you, is possible. And then we need a way to communicate send quantum information between qubits over some relatively large distance, like a centimeter. And I'll show you how we do that. And then use a controlled phase gate and how that works to generate Bell states and do an entanglement witness measurement, CHSH measurement, and do the Grover search algorithm. So you know about the NMR implementation of sort of quantum computing. Debate about whether it's really quantum. The debate is because you need many, many, many spins in order to see a signal, because they have such tiny magnetic moments, they don't interact very well with your measuring apparatus or with each other, which is why their coherence times are so long. Of course, we have the engineering problem that we want qubits to interact when they should interact, and interact with each other and with the detector when we want them to, and not when we don't want them to. And we're going to do the equivalent of this, that is to say, have an electrical circuit that has quantized energy levels, two of which we somehow can have access to, and the others we can somehow ignore. And it turns out that because we're talking about electrical charges rather than nuclear magnetic moments, the size of the coupling to detectors and to each other is much larger. And it's perfectly possible to do this equivalent experiment on single spins. Of course, they're not really spins. They're ground and excited states of some complicated circuit. So here's an example of a Ramsey fringe experiment where you make a pi over 2 rotation, you wait some length of time while the qubit undergoes approximately unitary evolution, e to the minus I Hamiltonian times time. And then you make another pi over 2 rotation that converts the phase angle through which the qubit has evolved into polarization up and down, which is what you can measure. And you see a beautiful sinusoidal fit with a simple single exponential decay time corresponding to loss of phase coherence between in the superposition of the two states of the qubit. Don't be fooled by the fact that you only see 30 or 40 oscillations here. This is a kind of stroboscopic picture of the precession. It's actually precessing 100,000 times before it decays. So the coherence is good in that, very good in that sense. But still needs to be, it's never good enough, right? It needs to be a couple orders of magnitude better.
Could have a slight bias, is that typical? The convergence.
Yeah, that is because of the nature of the particular readout. This is a kind of digital readout that you know, a detector clicks or doesn't click, and it's not perfectly unbiased.
Well, so what you mean by stroboscopic is that you're just like superposing like little measurements at different separated time intervals, or?
Yeah, I mean, so roughly, so imagine that the qubit has a transition frequency of 10 gigahertz, meaning the spin is precessing at 10 gigahertz. And imagine I arrange things to be in a frame of reference, which is rotating at 9.95 gigahertz.
Okay.
I will just see a very slow resulting precession.
Okay.
And what I mean by that frame of reference is a technical detail that has to do with, you know, how I keep time with my microwave generators.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is visibility the maximum? I mean, how do you get 87%?
Or I just don't know what. So contrast is this minus that, and visibility is the fraction. It's calibrated according to the detector that is. Suppose the detector didn't work very well and the signal went from here to here, but you had measured carefully and, you know, 100% polarization was this and zero was that, then you could scale it up. So that's what I mean by visibility instead of contrast. This is the raw value. This is corrected for measurement efficiency.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, so that's sort of the maximum amplitude.
Exactly, yeah. Okay, so there are different kinds of superconducting circuits, and I'm not going to try to explain what they are or even what any of those symbols mean if you don't know. But we're going to focus on charge-based qubits and throw away this part of the circuit too, and just have two little pieces of metal, which are superconducting and separated by a very thin layer of aluminum oxide, which acts like a potential barrier to the electrons. But nevertheless, quantum mechanically, they can tunnel from one side to the other. And I'll just explain how that little so-called Josephson junction makes a quantum circuit. And the fact that it's superconducting means it has very few degrees of freedom, despite the fact that there are 10 to the 11 electrons in each piece of metal. But just a little history so you have some sense of scale. I mean, I would say, you know, people are trying ion traps and NMR and quantum dots and nuclear spins and electron spins, and there's no clear winner yet. And the history is very, still very fresh. The first superconducting qubit was demonstrated, had quantized energy levels, 1998, published in 99. Michel Devoret and collaborators found a way to, the coherence time was immeasurably short here, found a way to make it orders of magnitude longer here. People are beginning to do experiments with two qubits, low fidelity, CNOT gates and so forth have been done. John Martinez here at UCSB has recently, yesterday, published in Nature a measurement loophole-free violation of the Bell inequality for 2 qubits. Of course, they're not separated by a space-like distance, so that loophole is still there. I'll show you data from us with measurement of the same quantity, but not closing the measurement loophole. And then just this year, the first simple algorithms have been run on solid state systems. So what's our Moore's Law situation? It's not as good as this. It's, so far it's this. And I would say at this time next year, we'll have 4 working. I mean, we have the Martinez group is trying it, and we're trying it. But what has improved dramatically, not the number of qubits, but the coherence time from sub-nanosecond up to sort of 3 microseconds, and a certain other measurement of the coherence time is up to 30 microseconds. So there's really been an approximately exponential increase. Whether it will keep going, I don't know at this point.
What's the difference between T1 and T2 again?
I know what
the two are. I never know which ones.
So T1 is the energy relaxation, the relaxation of sigma z, if you have a spin in a magnetic field in the z direction. So the rate of transitions from excited to ground, typically. Temperature is very low. You rarely go in the other direction. And T2 is if I make a superposition of up and down, let it process, and then see if it still has the expected phase. That's T2.
And so there seems to be some trade-off here where, like, you can increase T2 but at the expense of decreasing T1. Is that real, or is that an artifact?
These are just particular samples.
Sure, sure.
There's a speed limit. A T2 can never exceed 2 T1. Hmm. There are separate physical mechanisms that limit T1 and T2, so they're not exactly correlated, but there's a bound on there. So it's hard to interpret that graph, I would say. Okay, so now I'm going to explain to you what is superconductivity. So we'd like to, and why would we want to use it? We'd like to end up with something that has a spectrum of quantized energy levels, like an atom. For example, the nuclear hyperfine states that are separated by microwave frequencies, and then far, far away at electron volt energies or petahertz frequencies, there are optical transitions. And then we'll use these two states as our qubit states. Well, so if you take a piece of metal, even a very small one, a micron scale piece of metal, such as the ones that we use to make our qubits, they'll have 10 to the 9 to 10 to the 12 electrons in them. And just they're interacting, they're fermions, they're very complicated, they have spins, and there's just a forest of energy levels. And you guys interested in complexity theory might like to think about the correlations and the positions of those levels, which are actually quite interesting. But you would not want to use that for a qubit. But miraculously, provided that the number of electrons in the grain is even, and there's an equal number of spin up and spin down electrons, and you go to low temperature, and it's a superconductor, the spectrum always looks like this. There's one single unique condensed state where all the electrons are somehow moving coherently, acting in concert, whatever phrase you'd like to say. There's a unique non-degenerate ground state, and then a relatively enormous energy gap, a millielectron volt, which is looks large if your temperature scale is below 1 Kelvin. And then this huge forest of complicated states that we don't want to deal with. So, but we've managed to freeze out and a huge number of degrees of freedom and get down to, unfortunately, 1. We were aiming for 2, and we overshot and ended up with 1. Okay, but still, we're close.
But does this imply that a single stray electron could like destroy a superconducting state by changing the parity?
A very perceptive question. The answer is yes. If there were an odd number of electrons, this would be gapless. However, and it almost is, it's almost certainly true that in a sample of this size, if you calculate theoretically the number that are in there from statistical mechanics, it can be pretty close to 0. But in practice, just stuff happens, if I may quote a former government official. And there are some around. But miraculously, they tend to go and sit in the corners away from where the action is, we think, and have no observable consequences. And for various physics reasons, you don't really want to know about. That, do you believe me? Okay, so we came very close to what we wanted, but we missed by a factor of 2.
So but we're just counting the conduction electrons. You're saying even or odd, or
well,
what kind of atoms are
there? The atoms have to be such that the electrons interact with the lattice vibrations in such a way that it becomes a superconductor. So there's a long, complicated story why you end up with that spectrum. But there's a wide class of materials where you do end up with that spectrum.
So this is like
Haldane conjecture in a sense? Duncan Haldane gets extremely upset when it's called a conjecture, as it was early on.
I'm a mathematician.
He said it's a fact, and it is. It took a while to prove it numerically. So this is idealized in one way, that I'm literally assuming the number of spin-up electrons is equal to the number of spin-down electrons. Exactly. That's the only idealization. Okay? So that's great. We got rid of all this forest of mess, but we have no degrees of freedom left. They're gapped out. And but we can fix that by having a junction between two pieces of metal. So the thing you need to understand is that if I had this spectrum for a little metallic grain, and I added 2 more electrons, 1 spin up and 1 spin down, the spectrum would still look exactly like this. Exactly, essentially exactly. Okay? So there's a one parameter family of states, these states that are labeled by how many pairs of electrons are in there. And we can access that family by having 2 pieces of metal and allowing certain miracle occurs and electrons, these even number of electrons, they always tunnel from one side to the other in pairs. And so you can stay within this low energy subspace of condensed states, each of which is unique if you specify the number of pairs that have tunneled relative to some reference state. Okay? That's the only thing you have to know about superconductivity.
Why does little n stay small?
Okay, so little n, the number that have transferred, may or may not stay small. And I'll explain that right now. So I'm going to write the Hamiltonian here in Dirac notation, which I hope is familiar to everybody. So there's a unique state, very complicated many-body state, but I can just give it a name and the number of excess Cooper pairs in it. And I can, if a pair tunnels from here to here, I increase n by 1. I hop from this, you know, I change n by 1, and that's what that operator does. So it's a little tri-diagonal element that moves you back and forth on this lattice. Now you can imagine, for those of you that have heard of the Coulomb interaction in some physics course you may or may not have taken, if you take away lots of electrons from here and put them over there, the potential energy, the Coulomb repulsion, is going to cause the energy to go up and up. And that's this term down here called the charging energy. And there's a 4 there because we count the charging energy of one electron as EC and a pair of electrons as 4. So you can think of hopping on a one-dimensional lattice of states. That's a familiar problem in condensed matter physics where electrons travel from atom to atom. This is mathematically equivalent. But now this lattice is curved in a parabola upward. If n gets too large, it doesn't want to go there because the energy will be too high. So that's what limits the size of n. In the structures that I'm going to tell you about, the range, you know, in the original charge qubit, this term was gigantic. And there's also a slight asymmetry. It's actually n minus some not necessarily integer constant all squared. And as a result, there were only this state and that state were the only two states that were important. In the qubits I'm going to tell you about, this term is, say, 1% of that term. And you may go, the uncertainty in the initial wave function, the charge, it may oscillate by a few, maybe 3, plus or minus 3, 2 or 3.
So then what exactly is the qubit here? It's like whether a Cooper pair has tunneled or hasn't tunneled?
So in the extreme limit where this is the big energy and there are only two states, the charge is almost a good quantum number. That is, you can be here and every once in a while hop over there and come back, or you can be here and every once in a while hop over there and come back. And so I will show you that first. But then when you get bigger fluctuations, there'll be a ground state distribution of amplitude over this, and then an excited state, and those are the qubit states. Does that make sense? So it's basically the amplitude of charge sloshing back and forth is the degree of excitation of the qubit.
Right. So what about the negative one?
As written here, this is perfectly symmetric, but it turns out there are stray electric fields that will bias one over the other. So that's actually my next point. We got the next. So in 1999, this group led by Yasuo Nakamura at NEC in Japan managed to build one of these things and do an experiment that showed that you could drive transitions back and forth between two quantized energy levels. So it didn't really demonstrate phase coherence, but you could see certain kind of what are called Rabi oscillations. I won't explain the details of it. But the time scale here is picoseconds, and they had $1 million pulse generator that could make pulses on picosecond time scales. And NEC can afford that. You paid for it with your cell phone chips. So it worked, but it didn't work very well. I mean, the time of coherence of superpositions was sort of immeasurably small. And here's the reason. That the charging energy was so large, and there was just some random electric field which maybe made a state where there was an extra pair here in the bottom, the ground state, and then the extra pair in the top, would be the excited state. So this might correspond to n equals 0, and this might be n equals plus 1. And n equals minus 1 would be even more expensive, so we won't worry about it. The problem with this state is you can see if there's an electric field, which of course pushes on electrons, if that electric field changes with time, the energy difference, how much energy it takes to excite this, will just wander up and down. And so the rate of precession of a superposition will speed up and slow down and speed up and slow down, and you'll lose track of the phase. You guys always work in some frame where the Hamiltonian is zero and they're just sitting still, but they're actually whipping around 10 billion times per second, so you have to, you can get dizzy watching them. So that means, you know, it's just a fact that there's some kind of stray electric field noises. We don't know where it comes from. It's just ubiquitous. It tends to have a 1 over, its power spectrum tends to be roughly 1 over frequency. There's lots more power at low frequencies than high. Can't be literally 1 over f because that integrates to an infinite amount of power. But there's some kind of, you know, stray electrons that move around. Something's happening, and it's that electric field's pushing on the Cooper pairs in the qubit. And here's a plot of the spectrum of the first three levels of that qubit when the charging energy term is very strong. And this is energy, and this is this stray electric field of the so-called offset charge. And
So it's not the n of two slides ago.
Yeah, it's so the real term I should have written down for the charging energy has this possible asymmetry that zero may not be the ground state. It would like to be, maybe the ground state would like to be 1/3 of a pair of electrons transferred, but that's not, you know, so it's frustrated. So as this quantity wiggles, the back and forth, the energy level separation varies, and you lose control of the phase of the superposition. Okay, I mean, it has a definite phase, but you don't know what it is. So then when you ensemble average that over many measurements, you get decay. So at least they observed quantized energy levels and made transitions between them, but couldn't do anything with coherent superpositions, so that's bad. So then Michel Debray and colleagues at Saclay, and then subsequently when he moved to Yale, used this trick borrowed from the atomic clock world, because after all, a quantum computer is a massive collection of atomic clocks, right? Just have to keep perfect time. And their phase of their superpositions. If you operate at a certain point where ng is a half, there's a symmetry such that the energy splitting is an extremum. So if ng is a half, then n equals 0 and 1 are degenerate. That degeneracy is lifted by the tunneling back and forth, and you get some level splitting, which to first order does not vary with the stray electric field. And the phase coherence time went from below nanoseconds to 300 to 500 nanoseconds. So huge advance. And the reason it stays at 300 to 500 nanoseconds has to do with just second order effects of the noise from the curvature here. You can measure the transition frequency, and it wanders around from this minimum up to larger values, and you still eventually lose track of the phase, but not nearly as fast. Okay. So they were then able to do the first Ramsey fringe experiment, again pi over 2, weight pi over 2, and then measure z. And they actually went to a double sweet spot, both in terms of the offset charge and magnetic field. There's a saddle point in the energy spectrum, and when you sit there, the phase coherence time is orders of magnitude longer than if you move away from there.
Sorry, what's the Wilson magnetic field?
Well, I didn't explain how magnetic fields also affect the transition frequency, but they do. Instead of what I drew, there's actually two Josephson junctions, one here and one here, and there's a little area, and if you put magnetic field through that area, and you recognize that pairs of electrons are actually waves, and when they go through, you get wave interference between those two paths of tunneling, which is modulated from constructive to destructive by how much magnetic flux is passing through that loop. So that term, it's a way of adjusting the size of that Josephson tunneling term, which is convenient, but if you have noise in the magnetic field, it also messes you up. So it's another control knob. If you know any atomic physics, one is the Stark shift, the other is the Zeeman shift of the transition levels.
What's cubic?
This is a charge-based.
Even charge qubit, but that was a squiggly.
Yeah, well, but it's a charged qubit because it just has two pieces of metal connected with what's effectively a single Josephson junction. But if you look closely, it's actually just a pair of junctions that acts like a single junction with an adjustable tunneling Josephson coupling. Okay, so as I said, you're now limited by the second order effects of this curvature, so we'd like to get rid of that. And that's the next step, this so-called transmon, which is nothing more than essentially the same circuit, but with that Josephson tunneling term that moves pairs of electrons from one side to the other, being much bigger than this Coulomb charging energy. So the quantum uncertainty in the number of tunneled pairs of electrons just goes up to 3 or 4, gets bigger, and it magically becomes exponentially less sensitive to this stray offset charge. And you can see that in the spectrum, which I won't derive for you. There's the Hamiltonian, the charging energy, the offset charge, and I'm in some other funny basis of dual to the number, the phase. And when you calculate the spectrum, as you lower the charging energy and increase the tunneling energy, the so-called charge dispersion, the amount that the energy levels wiggle when you vary this offset charge, goes down exponentially. Okay. And for reasonable parameters, you can make this frequency uncertainty be 1 hertz. Just, you know, the phase coherence time would be a second. It is not limited by something else. So that basically gets rid of this noise problem. And
what's the disadvantage of this trick?
Well, there's a slight disadvantage that the degree of anharmonicity of this, that is the difference, and it's getting closer and closer to a harmonic oscillator with evenly spaced levels. Mm. And that can't make a qubit, because when you try to drive this transition, you also drive that one. But it turns out you can make this anharmonicity be it's very easy to control, and you can make it 300 megahertz, which is plenty. We don't have fast enough electronics to take advantage of even bigger anharmonicity. So, in other words, if you want to make a pi pulse, you put on a microwave field that oscillates at this transition frequency and try to drive the system from here to here. If you make that pulse very short in time, it has a spread of frequencies, and that spread will eventually overlap this transition. But our electronics, you know, it's nanosecond timescales, but it's still 300 megahertz of anharmonicity is plenty for present day electronics.
Do you still know
how many pairs you have? No, so that's the thing. It's not that the qubit states are no pairs tunneled and one pair tunneled. You don't know. It's more like It's kind of like a harmonic oscillator. It's just slightly anharmonic. Yeah. So they're either a certain amount of zero-point uncertainty or some bigger sloshing. Those are the two states. Yeah. So now you can do these different experiments to measure the relaxation time. So T1, again, is how long if you put it in the excited state, you make a pi pulse and you wait and you see if it's still up there. It falls down exponentially. This particular qubit had 1.5 microsecond time. You can do this Ramsey fringe experiment to see the phase coherence, and you come close to the theoretical limit that T2 is twice T1. I just gave this talk a few minutes ago, and there was lots of discussion about whether this is the very best data we ever had or typical, and it's more or less the very best. But typical values are, 1 to 2 microseconds. There's one kind of dephasing that just comes from the fact that you can't have a superposition if you fall from the excited state to the ground state. That gives you this 2T1. And then there's this other effect of intrinsic dephasing if the transition frequency just wanders up and down due to noise or dirt or something. That gives a dephasing rate 1 over tau phi. And these are so close together that tau phi must be bigger than 35 microseconds. We don't know exactly how big. So that lends hope that if we can figure out how to stop it from the energy from relaxing, we'll be able to get another order of magnitude in coherence time. Why is the energy relaxing? Well, one thing is that the electromagnetic vacuum is itself quantized, has zero-point fluctuations. And an atom with an electron in an excited state can fall down and spontaneously emit a photon. In this case, the photon is a microwave photon. And we protect against that in certain ways by the surrounding circuitry. Another way is that there's something in the dirt can absorb the energy. And people are exploring how to make that better. But that's real dirt physics you don't really, none of us want to know about. But now the coherence times and the microwave control circuitry to send in microwave pulses which help slosh the electrons back and forth and drive transitions from ground to excited state can be done. And this is randomized benchmarking from following the technique that Knill et al. Invented, where you just do a whole sequence of Clifford gates, and no matter what you do, you're always one gate away from the z-axis. And so you can kind of figure out how much of your error is in your readout step, because that only happens once, and how much is in your gates, because you vary the length. And from this exponential fall off in average fidelity, we estimate there's about 1% error per gate. And I think we think we're beginning to understand now how to calibrate the pi pulses better and, slowly beat these things down. But still, obviously, some more orders of magnitude to go before you should buy stock.
So if I were to model that gate error, because if I understand correctly, what you have on the left, those are kind of the errors that always go on.
Always what?
The errors on the right, that's when you apply a gate. It says error per gate.
So here we applied 60 gates, and the fidelity to the target state was 60%, where this is in units where 50% is zero, I guess. I mean, random.
So, but if I would like to think about that noise of the gate, is it that with certain, with 1.2%, rather than applying the gate that I want to do, I could do turning it into a ground state or completely?
So what kind of things can happen that contribute to that? Well, a lot of it is just that in the finite time it takes to make the rotation, there's some T1 or T2 process, some noise process, which messes up the qubit state. That's one thing that happens. Mm-hmm. There's some another thing that's also on this scale is systematic over or under rotation. You're aiming for pi, and you go a little above or a little below. Mm-hmm. Another thing is that what constitutes a pi pulse on this qubit may actually be conditional a little bit on the state of the other qubits. That is, what you thought was a one qubit rotation is slightly entangling. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to learn how to calibrate all that while at the same time having a detector whose tomography and whose calibration we have to figure out. So I would pose that as a puzzle for us. Might be of interest to this group. So you have a black box. You're pretty sure there's n qubits in there. You know approximately the Hamiltonian. There's a detector in there. You know approximately how it works. You can send in pulses and you get out signals. Now calibrate the Hamiltonian and the detector simultaneously. How do I do that? And, we're trying to learn how to do that. So it's by these sequence of engineering steps, or, changing the way our atoms work. If we want them to interact with the photons more, we make them bigger. If we want them to be less sensitive to external noise, we change the ratio of certain parameters in it. And that's the kind of... The nice thing in atomic clocks is that every cesium atom in the universe has the same transition frequency if there aren't any electric or magnetic fields around. But the nice thing about these is, yeah, they're all different when you build them, but you can tune them, and you can change the design if you don't like it. So as a result of a sequence of, basically quantum engineering steps, we've gone from here to here in a decade, and the intrinsic phase coherence time is already up here somewhere, but the T2 is sort of stuck right here for now, and I'm hoping that the plot will keep going, but we don't know at this point. Sorry?
You said phase, and then you said...
So T phi is up here now.
Oh, okay.
T1 and T2 are stuck here, here in 2009. Okay, but the qubits are working well enough we could do a few things, we have to get them to talk to each other. And the way we like to, you can, because their excitations involve charges sloshing back and forth, you could just put them near each other, have a capacitor coupling them, and they would detect each other's motion. The way we like to do it, and which will work over much longer distances, is to have the qubits coupled to a kind of quantum bus that's represented by a microwave resonator cavity. So you can have one qubit that's excited emit a photon into this structure, which is just like an organ pipe for microwaves, and they rattle back and forth inside there, and then it can go over and be absorbed by the other qubit. So that's how they can talk to each other. And naively, what that just gives you is a swap gate where if one's excited, it transfers the excitation to the other. But we're going to end up using that in a different way to get a phase gate. The nice thing about having all of these wires be superconducting, so this is kind of a two-dimensional version of the coaxial cable that goes into your TV. It's not much different than that. And the nice thing about it being superconducting is these microwave photons can travel 10 kilometers without being absorbed. So when it's superconducting, there's that excitation gap which prevents dissipation. And so it's kind of like optical fiber for visible photons, where people have done these entanglement experiments over tens of kilometers. Now, having a dilution refrigerator with a 10 millikelvin and 10 kilometers long would be very expensive. So here's the processor. It's got, you know, as a chip, and there's two of these qubits at one end of the cavity and the other, and the microwave photons travel back and forth on that wire between them. And there are some other control wires. And we send in microwave pulses on this line. And if they're at the frequency of the resonator, they feel that they're detuned from the qubits. They don't cause any transitions in the qubits, but it turns out they suffer a phase shift, and you can measure the state of the qubits in an approximately QND way using that. Or you can send in microwaves at the transition frequency of the qubits and do rotations. So control and readout are all done on one wire. And so the entanglement is done with a conditional phase gate. You make this particular superposition, you change the sign of the term that has both qubits excited, and then it's no longer a product state. And you have entanglement. So how would you do that? Well, in NMR, there's a natural ZZ interaction. If the spins carry magnetic moments, and if they're close together, the magnetic field from this guy goes over and affects the transition frequency of that guy. And so you have a ZZ coupling that can be used to do this. We don't have that situation. We have this sort of swapping XX kind of coupling. And but we're going to take advantage of the effects of a third state in the qubit outside the computational subspace. So here is the spectrum of the qubit on the left. It's not just a two-level system. There are higher levels. And this transition frequency here is about 10% less than that. Here's the other qubit with its spectrum, and they're clearly far detuned from each other, and this swapping interaction by exchanging photons through the cavity is not doing anything. But by means of some magnetic fields that I apply, I can change the transition frequency of one of the qubits. And if you wanted them to swap, you would bring this transition into resonance with that one, and then they would swap. But instead, we bring this transition in resonance to that one. And because of the negative anharmonicity, this is still well detuned. And it's only this transition talking to that transition. And so you temporarily go outside of the computational subspace, and you pick up some energy shift, which when you integrate over time gives you a phase shift. And that phase shift occurs, that is, this swapping back and forth occurs if and only if both qubits start out in the excited state. Okay? So that's how you get the conditional operation.
Why did you
cheat? So we originally did it by bringing this level all the way down to here and doing square root of I swap. But we noticed it wasn't very high fidelity. And then we realized that on the way to getting there, we passed through a controlled phase shift region. And we said, why don't we just stop there and use that? And it worked much better.
So you wouldn't use the blue 0 and 1 because that would mess.
So suppose that I wanted to bring this into resonance with that. Then if this was in the ground state and I was in the excited state, they could swap. But in order to bring them into resonance, you have to pass through this very point that I'm showing you here, where this is in resonance with that already. And so you were getting some controlled phases that were messing up the swap. Okay, so then we said, why don't we just stop here and use the controlled phase and then go back, and that worked great.
That's because of the particular level spacings for your device.
Yeah, it happens to have negative anharmonicity and just happened to, work. We did not plan this. So I haven't told you exactly how you measure the state of the qubits and how you measure the joint state of two with one, but you can. And so this, you can carry out this circuit to make the four different Bell states with these fidelities and approximate concurrences, which is the current record. not spectacular, but it's the best we can do at the moment. How do we actually read out the state of the qubits? We only have one wire and one signal coming out. How do you get 2 bits of classical information? Well, each qubit is a kind of like a polarizable object. If you're sending photons through the resonator at some frequency, which is not the qubit transition frequencies, they still respond a little bit. And the way they respond depends on whether they're in the ground state or the excited state. And they cause the frequency of the resonator to change depending on the state of the qubit. So there are 4 different states for 2 qubits, and there are 4 different possible resonator frequencies, which can differ by many line widths of the resonator. So if you could measure that, you could get 2 bits of classical information. You could say they're both up, or one is up and one is down, or they're both down, or whatever. Okay? That's in theory. In practice, it's a little more complicated. But the transmitted amplitude of the microwaves that you can measure turns out to be a measurement of this operator. It's the polarization of the first qubit with some weight, the second with some weight, and their product with some weight. And all the weights are same order of magnitude. Okay? And so that's how you can end up measuring 2-qubit correlations with one signal. So I'm skipping over all the details. If you want to find, let's say, the polarization in the z basis of the left qubit, all you have to do is measure, make a measurement of the state, and then do it again with the flipping the right qubit, which changes the sign of these 2 terms, and then add them up, and you find out what the state of the left qubit is, the expectation value of sigma z. You can flip both qubits, and both of these signs will change, but the product won't change, and then you can measure the 2-qubit correlation in the z basis. If you want some other basis besides the z direction, you have to append pre-rotations of the qubits through whatever angle you want. If you want to measure x, you have to take x and turn it into z. So this readout, there's a lot of noise, classical noise that various amplifiers add to this. So the actual, in one shot, you only have about 10% readout fidelity, which normally would be fatal if you were trying to do 2-qubit correlations by making separate measurements, each of low fidelity. But because we're directly measuring the product of those 2 operators plus noise, we can average away the noise without screwing up the correlations. Okay, so here's a Pauli basis representation of the correlations. Here's the ground state. Left qubit has z equals 1, right qubit is z equals 1, the product is 1, and all the other correlators are at 0. That's the density matrix deduced by maximum likelihood. Here's the left qubit being flipped. Its spin is now close to minus 1. The right is still close to plus 1, but now the product is close to minus 1. And the nice thing about this Pauli representation is you can see here the bells, you know, if you stare at the density matrix, it's hard to tell if they're entangled. But here it's clear because all the single qubit expectations are close to 0, and their correlations are close to unity. Okay? So that's where the, whatever, 91% fidelity came from and the 80%. This is some concurrence estimated from the most likely density matrix, but we don't know how to assign error bars to that process. We'd be interested in suggestions on how to do that, since the transformations. That's the partial transpose. Okay, so now we'd like to do the entanglement witness. for these two guys, and there's this CHSH witness. If you can measure x and z for one qubit, and x prime and z prime for another qubit, and form this combination, and rotate the relative angle of measurement between the two, this witness will oscillate, and classically it cannot exceed 2, and quantum mechanically it can reach 2 root 2, and we reach 2.61. So the Martinez group gets 2.07, I think, but in a way that has no loopholes in the measurement. We have to, because we have low readout fidelity, we have to do lots of averaging, and in principle there's a demon that could come in and, you know, if the adjust the noise to confuse you. But anyway, it's still a pretty nice result. There's a sanity check on a product state where these oscillate in agreement with, good agreement with theory, and don't violate the bound of 2. Okay, so now you can use that ability to generate entanglement to run Grover's search algorithm or Deutsch-Chiozza.
So if you have an error in the measurement, is it that you have no outcome at all, or do you have like really noisy?
No, our errors consist of, there's a signal and a very large approximately Gaussian white noise on top of that.
Okay.
And if you just, because we can measure the product two operators, you just can average that away by making lots of measurements. Now, if that's the measurement per se, if the qubit decays, you're more likely to get 0 than 1. I mean, there's a slight bias because the qubit does tend to decay, but that's not in the measurement itself. Okay, so everybody here knows Grover's algorithm. We're going to look for a minus sign that an unknown oracle puts in superposition. And you can make a very compact version with a small gate set if you have a controlled phase gate. That's one nice thing. So there's an unknown, some rotations, some unknown oracle, some more rotations, a fixed entangling two-qubit rotation, some more one-particle rotations, and then state tomography to see what you've got. And it takes 10 pulses, 2 entangling gates. It's all over with in 104 nanoseconds, which is about a tenth of the lifetime of the superposition, so you would expect, you know, roughly a 10% error or so. So here's a little movie, kind of quantum debugger, showing this density matrix description of the state of the processor at the end of different points in the process. Of course, you can't actually look at the process without destroying it, but. So here's the ground state. We're starting here. There's the density matrix. Then we apply 2 pi over 2 rotations around the y-axis, so each qubit is pointing in the x direction. There's the completely flat density matrix that covers like all the possibilities that we're going to interfere. And then the graduate student chooses one of 4 oracles to put a minus sign in one of 4 places using the controlled phase gate, which is we have access to, and in this case chose the 3rd entry to get the minus sign. So you can see in the density matrix everybody changes sign in the 3rd row and column except where they intersect, because 2 minus signs is a plus sign. And then the graduate student, so then the postdoc has to continue to see where the graduate student put that. So there's a couple more 1-qubit rotations, which drive you into one of the 4 Bell states associated with the 4 places the minus sign can be. Then there is a fixed entangling gate, phase gate, that puts a minus sign always in the same place, always in the upper, in the 0-0 state. And that produces some complicated mess, but it's not no longer entangled, and you can see that by doing some more single qubit rotations, which take you, which focus all of the amplitude through this magic interference into a more or less a single spot.
This looks like Grover's out there.
That was what we were hoping you would say. And we get the correct answer 80% of the time. We have to actually look many times, because our final step of reading out which state the output register is in is not very good. So we actually didn't beat the, you know, number of the 2.25 classical looks. But everything but the readout, the quantum processor part seems to be working pretty well. And 80% is consistent with the known decay rates and decoherence rates of the individual qubits. So seems to be working. And so you can do Grover with all four oracles and get the weight in the four different places. They all have about the same fidelity. We don't take the square root here, so that's a more pessimistic fidelity. And you can also do Deutsch-Chose in the same way. I won't show that, but since you guys are mathematicians, I thought I'd show you the $100,000 in microwave equipment. This is a freestanding closed cycle refrigerator that goes from room temperature to 10 millikelvin in 24 hours. Pretty amazing. And of course, the postdoc said he needed the other resource was coffee pods. And so, as I said, we're still trying to kind of, it's like it's 1949 and we're trying to invent the transistor and dream about the Pentium processor, but it's incredibly early stages. But it's very dangerous to try to predict the future, as you can see from this cover of Popular Mechanics in 1949, talking about the ENIAC computer, which had 18,000 vacuum tubes and weighed 30 tons. Maybe someday you could get a computer as small as 1.5 tons. And so it's very dangerous to say things about the future. And again, I should emphasize that I'm not really an experimentalist. I'm a theorist. And experimental realities are tough to deal with. So this is what my day is like. So thank you. That's the group of people at Yale that have done all the work. And I hope you learned a little bit about experimental realities. Thank you.
How come no penguins in the talk from our Kansas group?
So it seems like your roadblock right now is the measurement part.
So high fidelity measurements are not necessary for quantum computation, neither for quantum error correction nor for running the computer. If you have a 30% readout fidelity, just run the program 3 times and take the majority rule of the answers. But I say that because our readout fidelity is not high. Our competition across the street here has 94% readout fidelity for their kind of qubits, but much shorter coherence times. So different groups have different advantages in the race right now. But we can get better amplifiers that with lower noise, which will make our readout fidelity much better. But for us, the most important thing is getting the phase coherence times of the qubits longer and longer and longer, and the gates higher and higher fidelity. The readout, there's a kind of quantum error correction where you have a high fidelity readout of something and then you decide afterwards to make some unitary rotation. I mean, an error is something non-unitary. So you have to do something non-unitary to kill it, either a decision based on a measurement, but there's another way you can do it, of just flushing the entropy into some ancillary qubits. And then if you have a very good reset, where you can flush that energy away somewhere, and that works just as well into a bath. And we have a very good reset. So, but you know, we certainly will continue to try to improve the readout.
I suppose when you have a single qubit instead of two coupled to the resonator, the readout is much better.
So if we optimize the parameters to optimize the readout, not the coherence time of the qubit, we can easily get 70%.
But a lot of the problem is you're trying to distinguish four states.
Yeah, so in this particular setup where you have one wire, and the more qubits you cram into the cavity, the more states you have to distinguish, we do have a limitation there. That's right. Yeah.
You talked about going to four qubits. Are you going to do an architecture with four qubits on a single resonator?
Yeah. So that mask has actually, the lithography mask has been constructed, and within the next few months we will have a resonator just like that with four qubits in it. If three of them work, we'll try for GHZ. If all four work, we'll try something even better.
Now, in that case, how do you do measurement?
Again, we'll have we will have a harder time, because if you want to really distinguish all 2^4 states, all 16 states, it's going to be hard. Yeah. So, but one thing we can do is suppose that you set it up so that if all the qubits are in the ground state, the cavity transmits at a certain frequency. And if any of the qubits are in an excited state, the cavity pulls several ninelets away. So you can measure is it's either all zeros or it's something else and we don't know what it is. That's enough. Right, because you can keep rotating your state and measuring the amplitude in 0, 0, and eventually you can get all the amplitudes in the state. But you have to do more measurements. So you don't actually have to resolve all 16 states. So that's the crutch that we're leaning on.
Charge question. What are like the advantages and disadvantages of superconducting architecture compared to ion traps, let's say?
So, as I said, it's very early days, and you know, there's no clear winner. The ion trap people—I mean, Dave Wineland is a buddy of mine, and every time I see him, I say, "You're eating my lunch." And every time he sees me, he says, "You're eating my lunch." And you know, they have 10-minute coherence times and you know, clock transitions. Pretty nice. On the other hand, they've done, you know, Reiner Blatt's done 8 ions or something, but scaling up where you're limited to kind of 7 or 8 ions in the processor part, and you have to swap some out and physically swap them around. They're starting to learn how to do that, and there's no telling, I mean, what they'll be able to do. But boy, for us, it looks really hard. And they have like laser noise. Like they can do the Ramsey experiment where they do a pi over 2 pulse, wait 60 seconds, do another pi over 2 pulse, get fantastic fringes. But they can't do Robbie flopping. They can't do that pi over 2 pulse is not actually very good. Because from shot to shot, the laser amplitude jumps up and down. And whereas we can do that, we have the analog of laser noise coming from our microwave generators is just zero. So, you know, there are different pluses and minuses.
So one plus here is that the superconducting qubits are in some sense stay put and they don't have to be moved around in the same.
Yeah, they stay put and they there's no giant laser table. I mean, this is the whole thing. This is like 1 foot across and 2 feet high. some commercial electronics. The UCSB group uses handmade electronics for fast pulses, but we're just using Agilent and Tektronix. Stuff. Again, I say we. They don't let me actually touch the knobs. They let me be in the room, but, you know. And you can imagine, I mean, we haven't done it, but you could imagine that the way these are made with lithography is sort of similar to the way computer chips are made. You could imagine, since they stay put, you know, you could make lots of them and scale it up. But still, it's going to be very, very, very hard. I mean, I was talking to some reporter from Discover magazine this morning, and I said we've made so much progress that building a quantum computer has gone from impossible to impossible over 10. So, you know, we talk to each other. I mean, NMR, the NMR stuff that Ike Schwang did, just incredibly important for just trivial stuff, like how do you make 300 pulses in a row that are robust and, you know, just details, experimental details. So you're never probably going to really scale up with NMR, but all that work that they did is, and the pulse sequences and stuff, incredibly valuable. So we're all learning from each other, and as long as we win, we'll be happy.
You said the reset is very good. How fast is the reset?
So because our T1s are short, it's pretty good. But what we imagine doing is using the Purcell effect. If you want to, you know, just suddenly make T1 a lot shorter, just move the qubit up close to the cavity, it fluoresces, and then you bring it back. So we actually used that trick when we made a single photons on demand. We made the decay of the qubit 10 times shorter so that 90% of the time it decayed by emitting a photon. So you could take a qubit in a superposition of ground and excited and end up with the electromagnetic field in a superposition of 0 and 1 photons, and you could measure the electric field and the energy and do fluorescence tomography on that flying qubit. So that's one possible way to get a fast reset.
What is limiting your T1? What are you doing now?
So that's an excellent question. There's an entire program, as you know, trying to figure out where the losses come from. So there are two ways that qubits can lose energy. One is just spontaneous emission of photons, just like atoms, due to the vacuum fluctuations. And you can protect against that by putting that qubit inside a cavity that does not have a photon mode at that frequency. And that will enhance the lifetime, and we've seen that. This reset is where you make the qubit have the similar frequency to the cavity, and then it actually fluoresces faster. It's resonantly enhanced. So that's one mechanism. The other is that the dirt somehow has some kind of degrees of freedom that can absorb energy. Dielectric loss. We don't have any strong evidence one way or the other over which one is dominating.
So
the fact that there aren't literally an even number of electrons and they're not literally all paired up, there's a few stray ones running around, they can also in principle cause dissipation. We're not convinced in our particular geometry that that's a big effect, but it's another possibility for sure.
Yeah. When your loss mechanism in principle could be dominated by a relatively small number of degrees of freedom in your environment,
yeah,
then some form of dynamical decoupling might...
Right. So we don't have that. Yeah. The group here has focused on that they're like two-level fluctuators that, they did an experiment with swapping the coherence from their qubit to this strange piece of dirt, and the piece of dirt had a longer coherence time than the qubit.
That could be frustrating.
Yeah. So so we don't, we see very little of that. We have a much, we use different, somewhat different materials and fabrication techniques. We see very little of that. We tend to see just Markovian, you know, dirt. You know.
So your coupling is some,
to some continuum.
Lots of degrees.
Yeah. Yeah. It could just be the electromagnetic modes of the universe, or it could be some loss in the...
Can you put the whole thing in a cavity?
Well, it is in a kind of two-dimensional cavity. Now we're going to put that two-dimensional cavity inside a three-dimensional cavity and make all the walls superconducting and try to improve what we call microwave hygiene. Just, you know, make it so that the photons just cannot escape.
So, see, you've done Grover with your superconducting device, which is great. When are you going to do Sudoku puzzles?
I was having a good day until you said that.
Sorry.
Inside joke. Probably known to everybody. Yeah.
So do you have other ways of hooking these up besides putting them just in line like that?
Well, we'd like to generalize that to, you know, have multiple cavities, each with a few qubits in them, and couple those together, some hierarchical scheme. The group here is coupling theirs together now with resonant cavities, but in the past they've just used, you know, put them in close contact with through a capacitor. The advantage of, you know, using photons is that you can couple things that are relatively distant. So that's what we've been focusing on. You know, I'm sure there are other ideas out there. But I don't think there's no real obvious things other than electrical. Each one's electric field coupling to the other.
It could be inductive for two flux qubits.
Yeah, yeah. So that's been done. One of the things that you need to do is have a, in order to scale up, is have an extremely large on-off ratio for all the couplings. This phase coupling has about 100 to 1 on-off, this controlled phase gate has about 100 to 1 on-off ratio. Which is fine for now, but it won't be enough to when you have thousands of qubits. So people have talked about some kind of active circuit element in between the qubits which turns the coupling on and off in some way, but no real brilliant ideas on how to do that.
What limits it to 100?
Well, it's just the... So we're using some, you know, swapping to this other level, and it's just how much they're detuned, essentially. What we need to do in the next generation is make our coupling Gs smaller and move close, you know, I can
go into depth. Like 1 over detuning cubed or something?
Yeah, I mean, it's depends on exactly how you're doing it, but it's some power of inverse power of the detuning, right? And it's hard to get much, you know, it's hard to change the detuning by orders of magnitude. The phase gate thing, it's a little better. It's 100 to 1 was a little better than I would have initially guessed, but it makes some sense when you think about it. One idea we have is to try to have two coupling channels that interfere, and you can tune it up to a null someplace and get a bigger on-off ratio. But we haven't figured out exactly how to do that yet.
So you really go to a large system, 100 qubit. Are you still going to depend on that one cavity more to do measurement?
Well, it'll have to be an array of cavities, and you can read out little blocks of the qubits. I mean, there's no way we can, yeah. So we don't, you know, I said you can imagine, because these things are glued down, you can imagine scaling them up. But there's all kinds of technical reasons that it's very hard, and that's one of them.
Yeah. So you'll have some of the problems that the IonTrack guys have, where you'll have smaller modules that will then have.
Yeah, absolutely. So, but it's such early stage, and we've changed our qubit design so many times, and the group has here, and we've changed the gate, the 2-qubit gate, and you know, it's just still so early days. There's plenty of room for some fresh idea completely out of left field that'll solve all these problems. But it's still very, very hard.
What happened?
All right. Thanks.